Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Roman Empire had its great and powerful epoch. The British took their turn. Today, America wears the laurel wreath. This hour, we're talking about whether or not America can avoid the pitfalls of empire's end. We begin this hour in Washington, where today Enron whistleblower Sharon Watkins appeared before a Senate subcommittee. Richard Daley, a reporter with Congressional Quarterly, was there. I asked him what kind of reception Sharon Watkins got today on Capitol Hill.
Well, actually, it was very positive. The members thanked her for coming. They were very receptive to her ideas and her input on the company itself and on the situation that evolved.
We know, of course, that Sharon Watkins tried to warn Kenneth Lay last August that things were not going right on the accounting front. Did she recount that story for the congressman today?
She did, and actually they asked about his reaction to her comments, and she said he actually was very receptive. He seemed to take it very seriously, is what she said. So she assumed he would look into it and he would attempt to rectify things, or at least make sure he knew what was going on.
So the congressman must have asked her what she thinks happened, because it was not rectified, of course. How did she respond?
She responded that she did eventually find out that there was an investigation, an internal investigation, but it was done almost as a PR move within the company to allay people's fears. It wasn't substantive, and it didn't turn up anything. So she tried to work within the company to correct these problems. The theory she was operating under was that she could work with the other executives, and apparently there were other executives that wanted to help her and correct things there. She wanted to try to save not only the jobs, but the company, and, of course, all the investors' money.
How did Sharon Watkins come across today on Capitol Hill? Was this an angry whistleblower, or was this a loyal Enron employee trying to save the company?
More the latter. She was more the loyal employee. In fact, they did subpoena her. Although she voluntarily came, she asked to be subpoenaed because she is still an Enron employee. Of course, it's affected very many people, and she seemed honestly upset about that. But she did emphasize that, you know, she wanted what was best for the company and for the investors.
What did her relationship with Ken Lay, the Enron CEO, seem to be? Did she respect him, or did she see him as a black hat in this drama also?
She actually spoke very highly of him. She said she respected him then and still respects him now. She said he's a man of integrity. She thinks that he was just caught in an impossible situation.
But Sharon Watkins also went after some executives, talking about swindlers in the emperor's new clothes. Who was she critical of at Enron?
She was critical of Jeffrey Skilling, mainly, former CEO, and also Andrew Fastow. And she said that they were obstructionist, or it inspired a level of fear, which made her and other executives not only not discuss the problem that they all knew about, but when she did decide to do something about it, she tried to go around them.
What were congressmen in the hearings today digging most fiercely on? What were they trying to get from Sharon Watkins?
They were throwing out ideas, but they were also trying to determine how did this all happen. Basically, they wanted the inside view. She was on the inside. She still is to a certain extent. They did move her from her job at the time, but they didn't fire her. And she said that's a good sign as far as the quality of Enron trying to clean up its mess. She says they're not trying to sweep anything under the carpet at this point, and they are trying to deal with things. I think that they maybe were expecting her to be a little bit more critical of more people at Enron. But when she did place blame, it was pretty specific. She said certain people were obstructionist, and it was not a company-wide deal.
You were in the hearing room today. How did Sharon Watkins' personality come across?
She seemed actually very straightforward. Like, this is a very matter-of-fact thing that she had to say something. When she realized there were problems, she didn't seem like she ever considered any other option. One of the members of the panel actually credited her ability or her decision to stand up and say something and try to do something about it. From the time she started talking to the time she finished, she really had all their attention. And it was pretty amazing to see, because you don't see that too often.
Richard Daley is a reporter with Congressional Quarterly. He spoke to us from Washington. There is no remaining doubt that America is the world's towering superpower. But history has seen superpowers before and often called them empires. The Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and the British Empire all ascended the arc of great power, and when they got to the top, believed that the world would be their oyster for a long, long time, maybe forever. But empires fall. Rome fell to the Visigoth invasion. Britain was crippled by two world wars. It's a fast and furious slide down the backside of the imperial arc. Our guest this hour, historian Donald Kagan, says empires can extend their lives, but only when they're willing to take the reins and guide an unruly world in the direction of peace and security. Fail to do that, and even the greatest powers can join the list of imperial has-beens. Listeners, does America effectively sit atop an empire today? What side of the imperial arc is it on? And what can the United States learn from empires that have come and gone before it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight is Donald Kagan. He's the Hill House Professor of History and Classics at Yale University. His latest book is entitled While America Sleeps, Self-Delusion, Military Weakness, and the Threat to Peace. Good evening and welcome, Donald Kagan.
Good evening.
It's good to have you.
Thank you.
With us here in the studio is our guest news analyst, Lewis Gordon. He's chair of Africana Studies at Brown University. Good evening and welcome, Lewis Gordon.
Good evening.
Donald Kagan, it's a long time since I sat in your lecture hall at Yale and was just enthralled by your description of how the Greeks changed the way they slid around on the benches of their war galleys and rode that then technological advance to great power. We're delighted to have you with us tonight.
You're kidding.
No.
What year was that?
Oh, geez, I don't even want to say. Let's say it was before the internet boom, that's for sure. No, it's a couple of decades now, but it was unforgettable.
I'm glad you did well.
Well, we're all having fun. Donald Kagan, I know there's a lot to talk about here. I know that you don't draw a parallel too directly or much at all between America and the Roman Empire, but Rome always comes up in the conversations of great power, of imperial power. Would you just start us off by giving us Donald Kagan's thumbnail description of the rise and fall, the whys and wherefores of the Roman Empire in brief?
Oh, sure. Well, it's worth remembering that the word Roman Empire is often unconsciously used as though they were one word, but it actually, at the very least, means two different things.
Okay.
One is the story of Rome and its growing conquest until it became master of the entire Mediterranean Sea and the shores around it. That's the way we tend to use the word empire in our time.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we distinguish between the Roman Republic, which in fact conquered most of that empire, and the Roman Empire per se, which is when the government changed from a republican regime to essentially a monarchical one, when there was somebody called imperator,
mm-hmm,
or emperor.
Caesar.
In the conversation we're tending to have, it's the first usage that's relevant here.
All right. In any case, most of us think of it as Rome's ascent to great power projected over great distance.
Right.
What was the motivating quality that made that happen, and what made it come unraveled?
Well, the Romans achieved what they wanted largely because of their military power, which rested chiefly on a large army during the years when it conquered most of the empire, of citizens who were not compelled to do so. They originally there was a draft, but it came to be a voluntary thing, and their skill and determination and courage and discipline provided an army and their numbers,
mm-hmm,
which allowed them to conquer each of the states in succession that they tackled. There was some further expansion under the emperors, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of why they stopped being able to expand and indeed were unable ultimately to sustain themselves.
And this is really the question that gets to the heart of our interest, our paranoia, our curiosity tonight.
Yes, the great unsolved question posed most strikingly by Gibbon in the 18th century,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the question of why the Roman Empire fell. There are wonderfully goofy suggestions to respond to it. Gibbon's own answer is a rather interesting one. He said it's the wrong question. The question should not be why did the Roman Empire, mm-hmm, fall, but why did it last so long?
Fair enough.
I think there's something in that, because the whole history of the human race and of states and of powers is one of permanent change.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever stays the same. You know, it's interesting that the father of history, Herodotus, right at the beginning of his book, makes this point. He says, you know, some states today that were great in the past are now small, and some that are now small used to be great, and that's why I'm telling you the story of how all these things happen, because
right.
they keep changing.
Well, the change is eternal, but also the curiosity, the desire to handicap where we are in the arc of history.
Right.
I think Americans have felt that acutely since 9/11. You're saying that the empire was essentially built, in Rome's case, on the back of military power, those marching legions.
Yes.
Does that mean that the fall was related to a weakening of military power?
Yes. There was, I think, first of all, a relative diminution of power. Part of the reason the Romans fell, it's a very important part, is that the people who attacked them, mm-hmm. the various German tribes, came to be very numerous, and many of them had learned how to fight by serving in the Roman army, so that they had, in a sense, taught their ultimate destructors how to fight.
So,
and these opponents were very mm-hmm. numerous.
So it was a military threat that they ultimately recognized as something like their own. It wasn't a terrorist equivalent that came from the Vandals
like
and Visigoths.
These were people who crashed through their frontiers and blasted their way finally into Rome and beyond.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the lesson of Rome, and we'll come to Great Britain, but I guess looking at all the empires that you know and study, are there consistent lessons about what creates a great power and what begins its demise?
Certainly to the first question, no. The great empires that you can name each came to be a great empire in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any consistency about that. Rome, I've given you my general picture. Mm-hmm. Britain became the great empire through having a great navy, through having the advantage of being an island and therefore easily defended,
mm-hmm.
through mainly the development of the Industrial Revolution before anybody else did so,
mm-hmm.
so as to give them economic power that was unparalleled.
And the mercantilism off of that.
Yeah, and then, of course, you've left out the great empire that came to be the Spanish Empire.
Mm.
But before that was the Holy Roman Empire under Charles V. His mm-hmm. son, Philip II, made it into a vast, enormous empire. And in some ways, they were very much like the Romans. I like to say the Romans acquired their empire by theft. I mean, they just conquered people and
right.
took away what they needed and then imposed their rule. In the case of the Spaniards, that theft was of the precious metals of the New World.
Mm-hmm.
And since they had no substructure, no culture, no society that produced wealth, when they ran out of the money, mm-hmm. they ran out of power.
When you see the United States today and its sway around the world, and there's a big conversation we can have about this, but do you see an empire?
I do not, because I think only by using words as poetry, as metaphors, can you describe the United States situation as the same as any of the other empires we have named, because every one of them depended upon some form of military power directly, not indirectly, to achieve what they wanted, which was always the complete control of what happened in their colonial or possessions, and which were openly and without embarrassment and directly exploitation economically of what those, I mean, in the most simple sense, they took away their land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet, as you say, things always change. I want to ask, before the break's coming up here, I want to ask our guest analyst this evening, Lewis Gordon. How about you, Lewis Gordon? Do you see an empire in America's global sway?
Well, as a person from the third world, yes. In fact, generally speaking, when one speaks about the United States, many of the conditions just marked out, ranging from really dictating the economies in various regions of the world. There's a shift. There's no longer the governor who comes in formally and said this is a colony, but the fact that third world debt is such that the structures really, really benefit predominantly American economic institutions really maintain that kind of a relationship. There's also just a history to speak of. I mean, the United States did expand militarily in the 19th century. It did acquire land. It did after, for instance, Christians' conflict with Spain, acquire various Spanish possessions. And in many ways, in terms of the relationship the United States has to Latin America, such a relationship seems to hold.
We've got a great and beefy topic tonight. We're talking with Lewis Gordon and with historian Donald Kagan about the arc of empire. We've looked a bit at Rome, we'll look at Great Britain, and we'll look at the United States. Whether or not you think it's an empire, it's clearly a great power. Where is America in the arc of empire, if we can use the term, and where's it headed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about empire, about great powers, their sway over the world, how it rises and how it falls. Our guest is Professor Donald Kagan, history professor at Yale University, and tonight's news analyst, Lewis Gordon, chair of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. What do you think? Do you see America as the world's new imperial power? And if so, where is America in the arc of empire? What can we learn from empires past, whether or not you see America in those terms? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Donald Kagan, we don't want to get all tied up in definitions here, but you've heard Lewis Gordon's sort of nutshell assertion that he does see aspects of empire in the United States. What does it matter whether or not we call the United States an empire? Does it really? Can we still learn from these historic great powers whether or not we have the same characteristics in your view?
It always matters to try to understand how things are the same and how they're different.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say an elephant is just like a puppy dog, they're both mammals, that's not a very useful way of thinking about things. You have to make distinctions, and I think that's an important distinction. But I agree. That's not the key question. America has enormous power. It's not imperial power, but the fact is it has got great power. So we can agree on that and move forward.
Is it possible, just to stay one more second with that, is it possible that there is a new breed of empire, a new kind of empire? You're no doubt aware of Michael Hart's book of the title Empire, and he describes the U.S. as now a new kind of empire, this diffuse blend of technology and powerful economics and globalization. Is it possible, as you say, things always change, that evolution has simply brought us to a new kind of empire?
You must ask yourself, what's the value of calling the United States an empire? It's only meant as propaganda. It's meant to blacken it. Nobody thinks well of empire in our time. That's what the point is. So if it's a new type, it's so new that I think it's useful to have a new name. But that's not an important question. I think the important question is, what follows from the fact of American power, however you want to characterize.
Mm-hmm. And in that regard, you look to the British Empire as one from which the United States might draw some current lessons.
Yes, because there are many, many useful analogies between the two. I think it is very important, for instance, that the Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire and the Spanish Empire, to some degree, were continental powers.
Mm-hmm.
And they expanded essentially through armies. And that required that they actually have the physical control of all of these places. That had certain characteristics, but one of the characteristics was to limit the power that they could have, because there's only so many men you can have, and that's a problem. If you're a naval power, or now a power that can, you know, move around the world very swiftly, that gives you tremendously greater possibilities, so that the British and the Americans are similar in that way. Also, this is very important.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the Roman Empire or any ancient empire, the Ottoman Empire, anything before the 19th century, the only way a great power could become greater in any respect was at the expense of somebody else,
mm-hmm.
by actually exploiting them directly in the ways I've suggested.
Mm-hmm.
With the Industrial Revolution and the great technological revolutions that came after that, it is possible to create wealth not at the expense of somebody else. Both the British and the United States now are producers, enormous producers of wealth, and that changes the picture altogether. In my opinion, it allows for the possibility of a greater longevity for powers that have this advantage,
mm-hmm.
and also the greater possibility of peace, because they don't need to conquer other peoples in order to continue to have their wealth grow.
Because their influence is based on economic reach and not on strictly
on their
military.
Own capacity to produce wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very big difference.
So You've described how Britain extended its realm through its naval power and by way of naval power, projecting its Industrial Revolution power.
Yeah, but first it had to create the Industrial Revolution. That was the other great thing that it could do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So once that's in hand, it did indeed straddle the world, and straddled the world for a long time. What were the factors? And this we're tuned to right now when the United States wonders, well, are we on the ascent, the plateau, the descent? What were the factors that led to the unraveling of the British Empire?
Here I think there are some very important similarities, but also some very important dissimilarities, and we have to look at both of those. The similarities, I think, are both were so successful economically that they became fundamentally fat, happy countries who were reluctant to pay the price that is necessary to maintain your security, to maintain the status quo, however you want to put it.
Comparing Britain and the United States there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Both were countries either democratic or on the way to democratic, so that there were all kinds of forces in society who had reason to resist making the sacrifices that were necessary. There's a tremendous inherent pressure in societies like that that must be attended to,
mm-hmm.
that want to have expenditure of government funds for internal benefits, for social improvements, and so on, usually at the expense of the military strength that's necessary to maintain your situation. So there's a conflict in this kind of empire, mm-hmm. which was not present so much in other empires. So you see that happening both in Britain and in the United States.
So the demands for domestic spending and comfort led to opposition to spending on military power abroad.
Yes, and I would say another thing. Both of them, the United States and Great Britain, depended upon a modern understanding of Christianity, which has a very important pacifist strain. Even people who aren't Christians, they're sort of part of the culture that Christianity produces. Modern Christianity has emphasized the Sermon on the Mount rather than other aspects of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a powerful pacifist strain in our societies, which comes not only from the search for comfort or social betterment, but from another direction. That's also a problem that these states have to confront.
Donald Kagan, stand by. I want to listen to perhaps the voice of the convergence of these very factors you describe. In October 1938, of course, Germany was making aggressive moves toward Czechoslovakia. The British Empire was still recovering from the ravages of World War I, had to decide what to do. On October 27th, 1938, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain told the world that Britain would do nothing.
How horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. I shall not give up the hope of a peaceful solution or abandon my efforts for peace as long as any chance for peace remains. We cannot, in all circumstances, undertake to involve the whole British Empire in war simply on her account.
British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain speaking on the eve of war in 1938. Donald Kagan, in that instance, Neville Chamberlain was not willing to take up the sword. It's a very different response we've seen from the United States in reaction to September 11th. Do you think that the U.S., unlike the Great Britain, is overcoming the factors you described as leading?
Remember that there's a very big difference. Chamberlain was refusing to defend a different country that had not yet been attacked.
Fair enough.
Britain had not been attacked. When Britain finally was Hitler mm-hmm. defied a British commitment, and it was Britain that was being challenged, Chamberlain couldn't keep the British out. It's very important to remember
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States, look what the United States has tolerated over the past 8 years as a preliminary to this terrorist attack with no pressure whatever on the government to do anything about
yeah.
it. I'm afraid the analogy is one that we ought to take quite seriously.
You mean that the series of terrorist attacks
sure.
that were not answered earlier?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And the president and the regime worked hard to do nothing about it, and they felt no pressure from the American people.
So in the U.S. response post 9/11, do you see a declining power or a vigorous power?
The United States is still an enormously vigorous power. The objective aspects of American strength are very great. there has never been a power in the history of the world with the economic strength that the United States has, and with the substructure still to sustain that over a period of time. And, of course, there never has been a state since the Roman Empire dominated the Mediterranean, which has had such a relative superiority in military power, even now, when it's not, in my judgment, even adequate, even now, over everybody else. So it is enormously strong, and it is not declining in that sense. The response to this particular attack suggests that the fundamentals necessary for any state to survive are still in place. But I don't think we can afford to be overly comfortable. You see, in my view, in the year 2002, being able to win wars, even in complicated situations like this, is not good enough. We have to be able to deter wars, to prevent wars. These people could perfectly well still use a weapon of mass destruction to bring about a disaster that no one has ever experienced in the world, except perhaps the Japanese in the First World War. And it's intolerable that we should not prevent that.
So deterrence through physical threat or intimidation or fear of...
I think it's a multiple thing that has to be done. Everybody knows that the United States has enormous military power. These people who launched this attack knew that. The problem always is when our opponent believes we lack the will, the character, to do anything about it.
Lewis Gordon, I want to bring you in. When you think about the character and durability of American global power projection, where do your thoughts turn?
Well, my thoughts go through three thinkers, actually. They go through Nietzsche, Ortega y Gasset, and Hannah Arendt. Because of Nietzsche, Nietzsche reminds us that human institutions don't last forever. And a lot of the discussions that we have around declines of empires are really related to discussions of decadence. But decadence is often misunderstood in terms of moral, you know, mishap, you know, bad character in those features, rather than a point at which a society can be tired or have outlived its resources. In terms of Ortega y Gasset, he brings up one very important feature of empires and one important feature of world powers, which is that they set standards. And in many ways, the ability to set standards also creates enormous responsibility with that, you know, with that ability, that often in a situation where if one is standing on as a major power, failure to do so could lead to catastrophic consequences. Now, Hannah Arendt, however, brings it out in a more complicated way, because empires are also functioning as sites of authority. They become a center through which one tends to organize not only values but also systems of relations, whether they be international, political, or moral. The thing about empires, though, whether we go back to the Roman Empire or the British Empire or the empire of today, is the question of consumption. Empires create centers of consumptions, point consumption, points where people just consume more than others. And that dynamic of consumption has an impact in terms of the longevity of that society. I think what's different about the U.S. is that we are a society that has access to unprecedented level of consumption than any other society in history. There's just no comparison. And that's one of the reasons why processes of decay seem to be more accelerated in the society than it has been in a lot of the others. It's remarkable how short the U.S. has been number one on the stage and how quickly certain processes have already begun to come around.
Fascinating. Listeners, Lewis Gordon says he sees consumption as potentially speeding up the cycle of power, perhaps of empire here. Donald Kagan says he sees economic power and its new expression around the world potentially giving more longevity to America's place in the world. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
Question is, I suppose this is coming from the cliche, perhaps truth, that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
We're trying to learn here, Paul.
Okay. Can we look at any disaffection in the past that parallels what's going on in the Islamic culture that led to the downfall of empires as a result of disaffection in distant countries, distant continents, and connecting that to perceived grievances that are not entirely the empire's fault?
That's a great question. Donald Kagan, how about it? Can you cite from history examples where a great power was surging along, and in some distant corner of the realm, an alternate power or culture said, "We don't like this," and that ultimately led to downfall?
No, I don't. I don't know anything that quite resembles this. The usual pattern of empires that are threatened and then finally sometimes fall. This would have been true of China at various times in its history, and it was true of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody outside the empire, not necessarily having any other grievance except that they wanted to have what was inside the empire,
mm-hmm.
would then, through its superior capacity to fight one way and another, to take it out. Here, you know, since we really live in one world,
yes.
If one makes the analogy of the angry Islamic peoples to the barbarians, they are within us. They are within the empire.
Right.
So there's no...
They're already inside the gates.
That's right. And they, of course, are not barbaric peoples in the old sense.
I mean, what are the implications? Lewis Gordon?
No, just saying there is another historical analogy, of course, which is, Judea. I mean, in many ways, the various conflicts led to various forms of cultural fusions. I mean, as was rightly pointed out earlier by Professor Kagan, yeah, there were different periods. There was the Roman Empire. There's a Holy Roman Empire. But the Holy Roman Empire would not have existed if there weren't a colony, basically,
mm-hmm.
that was Judea. And in many ways... there were forms of resistance. Paul, for instance, was a fantastic organizer in terms of setting an agenda for a future that was very different. And we don't really know right now what sort of cultural transformation may exist in the future or what would happen in terms of future empires.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's very clear, though, the point about the moral fabric of empires is well stated. Today, empires are embarrassed to have that name. It's better to have another name, and I think that embarrassment affects the way an imperial power will behave. It has to simultaneously be imperial, but publicly non-imperial.
Mm-hmm. And Donald Kagan, to the point of Islam being within this what is now a global realm, what are the implications of that to feel the opposition from within?
I think it makes for a very dangerous situation if you're not in accord with these unhappy people, because they can do the kinds of things that we've seen. They can operate. They don't have to conquer. We can't beat them by just defeating them on the frontiers. We've got to deal with all this difficult internal stuff. That's one side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the other side of it is that if we were to wage a thorough and properly serious and effective war, we could have victory and considerable success much more easily. In my opinion, for instance, if we were to wage the current war as aggressively as President Bush claims his plan is,
mm-hmm.
I think we could put an end to this kind of thing and discredit this aspect of Islamic life and make a healthier aspect of Islamic life the dominant one, one with which the entire world could live, simply by taking out a few of these dangerous opponents that we have, because they too are part of the larger picture and more readily done away with, I believe.
There's a vote for power, using its power in the interests of longer-term stability from Donald Kagan, history professor at Yale. We're talking about the arc of empire tonight. Do you see America as the world's new imperial power? Is America still in the ascent, on the plateau, in descent? Do you want to see America as an imperial power, or does America have a choice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the arc of empire tonight and where America might stand in that arc, about how global power is projected and what America might learn from the lessons of empires, great powers that have gone before. Our guest is Donald Kagan. He's professor of history at Yale. And our news analyst tonight is Lewis Gordon, chair of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Donald Kagan and Lewis Gordon, we have a lot of calls. Let's try and talk to our listeners. Heather is on the line. Welcome, Heather. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Professor Kagan, at Cornell 40 years ago, we were talking about the Athenian Empire.
Is this Heather Cole?
It is.
Oh, isn't it delightful to hear from you?
It's old home week.
And I'm interested in language, the kine, and coinage, money. And I'm interested to hear what you and Professor Gordon have to say about the pervasiveness of language and the pervasiveness of currency and what they have to do with the rise and fall of empires and a kind of inadvertent imperialism that's embedded in our popular culture that is about language and is about money.
And Heather, are you suggesting that these are, in fact, currencies of American power or imperial power today?
Yes, I am.
Donald Kagan?
Well, she's absolutely right. If you use the word empire metaphorically, which is okay as long as you know what you're doing.
All right. We're trying to.
I think it's obvious that in the sense our language, it has enormous power in terms of expanding American influence, and the language that's most relevant is the language of our political system. The power of democracy and Republican government, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States really is an enormous power, and it has enhanced American strength and will, as long as it's still credible.
And coinage?
Coinage. American wealth is an enormous power in the world, and I have a feeling Mr. Gordon wouldn't agree with me about as to the way that works, but one way it does is that it makes other people wealthy, which is against the common sense that somehow we exploit people and they are worse off after we've had something to do with them. Well, not economically. When Americans get wealthy in their contact with other peoples, those other people generally get wealthy. Those associations are almost always voluntary on both sides because both sides feel they get something out of it. No question, American wealth and American capacity to create wealth are a great source of power.
Lewis Gordon, I want to turn to that, but first, Heather, Donald Kagan turns to the language of democracy as the most salient aspect of language here. Is that what you have in mind?
It's a really elevated way of expressing it, but when we travel abroad, we're hearing English at every level,
yeah,
and in every aspect of society. But as to what Don says, I buy it.
Can I just add
yes,
one
please.
More thing? Because she said, what about American, was it popular culture was the issue?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, that is one I deplore totally.
You deplore its projection?
Yeah, it's enormously powerful. It has poisoned the whole world.
I mean, one really has to wonder if it's the language of Thomas Jefferson or Britney Spears that's the more pervasive.
That aspect of American language is probably as powerful as any aspect of it. I think have to face it squarely. I think it has debased the world's culture. I deplore it.
I think that our earlier caller was talking about the deterioration of values, and I think we've really got to be paying attention to that.
Yeah, I don't know. We have to cure ourselves first before we can save the rest of the world.
Empire, cure thyself. Heather, thank you very much for your call. Andrea's on the line. Welcome, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. I love this conversation. I'm so glad you're having it.
Happy to.
Yeah. I used to be an elementary school teacher, and one of my topics was the rise and fall of Rome.
Okay.
And I remember spending long hours with the kids outlining the Pax Romana, which sort of took in the whole Mediterranean basin.
Mm-hmm.
And it amuses me, and it's amused me for the last 5 years. Whenever I'm a little baffled by what's happening in Washington, I just mentally switch it to Rome, and it all seems to make sense. You know, people coming in from the outer provinces to Rome or Washington, and important people from Rome or Washington being set out to quell this disturbance or that disturbance.
But you hear Donald Kagan pretty much rejects that parallel.
Well, the thing is this. If you really listen to both Donald Kagan's language and the language that's coming out of Washington these days, you hear imperialism. In the phrase, for example, take out Saddam Hussein. I mean, this is the head of a country. And this is like, what are we talking about here? Just walking over? I mean, it's like the kind of informal, if you want to call it, language, as opposed to the language of democracy, seems to be taking over. We're talking imperial language, and I think people in Washington are thinking empire. I don't buy the Jeffersonian stuff.
Andrea, thanks for your comment. Don Kagan, I'm sure you'll want to respond, but let's have Lewis Gordon come in first.
Well, there are two features also we should bear in mind. One of them is that an empire can unilaterally dictate the conditions on not only on its commerce, but also unilaterally dictate certain conditions on how cultural production is made. And the discussion around English is an example of that, but also the question of currency. A distinction between us and Rome is that Rome, for instance, in many cases focused on building up infrastructures where it went. But in many ways, there are many countries in Africa, in parts of Latin America, who are still waiting for the infrastructural payoff in these relations. And one of the reasons for this is because what we find instead is that there's great economic profit for individuals who represent or function as liaisons between the United States and these countries rather than the formal relationship in terms of the actual structures there. What these countries find themselves doing is donating a lot of their economies to paying off massive debts, in some cases paying them off 4 to 5 times more. And I can't see how that is actually benefiting those countries, but I could see how it benefits the banks in this country.
Donald Kagan, do you buy that Rome was more effective in building up its provinces than the United States?
It sure was. They certainly put those infrastructures in there because they had Roman armies sitting on those people, mm-hmm. so they wanted excellent roads for the Roman army to be able to march to beat them on the head when they got out of line.
But that's not necessarily an infrastructure that
that's the infrastructure they did.
Right, yeah, but not necessarily
totally
that the folks down home would be so happy for.
That's right. I don't think that the Romans deserve credit for altruism, although that was a side benefit.
And Donald Kagan, how about Andrea's point? And she's a school teacher. She's taught Roman. It's a tough point. She says not only does the U.S. look like the Roman Empire to her, but in your language and President Bush's, she hears an imperialist tone.
No, well, she may hear it, but I have another basis for the tone that I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that somebody in 1938 or 37 had said, "Let's take out Adolf Hitler." Before the United States was the dominant power in the world, I wish the British and the French had done that when they could. This has got nothing to do with imperialism. This
Donald
has
Kagan,
got to do with recognizing a great evil and taking action against it.
Our time is running down, but I know you've said that the Cold War background actually heartens your confidence about the future of American power.
That's true.
Why so?
It's because those of us are old enough to remember when the Cold War got started in the late 40s, early 50s, all sorts of wise men in the world, including Bertrand Russell and folks like that, were predicting that war between the United States and the Soviet Union was inevitable, and it was going to be a nuclear war, and we're all going to get blown up. The American approach was to attempt to prevent that war through strength, economic, military, and political. And the political being the attempt to spread our notions about better forms of government and worse. We stuck with it for half a century at great cost, and the consequence was a peaceful solution to that problem, no war, and a world that looks a lot better than it did at that point, even now, in the midst of this terrible war. That suggests we can overcome these great, great threats if we attend to them properly.
We'll see what comes next. Donald Kagan, we're out of time. Donald Kagan is Hill House Professor of History and Classics at Yale. His most recent book is While America Sleeps, Self-Delusion, Military Weakness, and the Threat to Peace. Thank you very much, Donald Kagan, for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And thank you, Lewis Gordon, for being with us this hour.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Listeners, for ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In the days after the attacks of September 11th, the nation tried to unify. American flags adorned cars and buildings, patriotic music filled the airwaves, and the Pledge of Allegiance rang out in classrooms. Photographer Liz Linder noticed a different trend. She started to observe the patriotic messages that covered the roadside marquees of car washes, restaurants, hotels, and chain stores. She was drawn to photograph the earnest and unlikely signs along New England's Route 1. The result is her latest exhibition called God Bless America, Reading the Signs. It's currently at the Piano Gallery in Boston's South End. We caught up with her and asked how she was prompted to pursue this phenom of patriotic road signs.
I was driving from a wedding in Vermont to a wedding in Massachusetts the Sunday following the attacks. I was driving in the morning, it was daylight, and I started seeing these signs, like, God bless America, my home, sweet home. Longer signs. I don't remember what the longest sign was. I took my first picture of this really long sign, and it had, like, some kind of testimony about war and peace and liberty and America and Americana, and it was beautiful. And I feel like the project really decided me. I didn't decide at any point to do this. I just started to do it. I saw the signs and I responded. I found it was one of the things that calmed me down when I was working and when I was trying to just make my life function. I would go on these few-hour trips up Route 1, you know, like hunting for signs. So I made two editions of my favorite signs. One is this very, it's a black and white photograph. It's one of the first that I took when I was still using my black and white camera. And it's just this very stark kind of backlit God Bless America sign. And it almost seemed like God Bless America was like the mantra, you know, to keep the business going. It's got this kind of timeless quality. It feels a little bit like Robert Frank took it, maybe. The other sign that I keep driving by still, even after it's been in the papers, is the sign around Fresh Pond, and it says, America will not forget, and the letters are starting to just fall apart and drip down, and I have photographed the sign in various stages of degeneration. It's one of the signs people respond to the most strongly. It seems to sort of sum up part of what I'm trying to show, which is we have forgotten in a certain way about certain things, but we're saying we don't want to forget. When I first started driving, I noticed probably a few more of the longer messages. There's one on the wall here. Liberty is one of the most valuable blessings heaven has bestowed on mankind. No advertisements. Kind of like when there were no advertisements on TV. But as time went on, I kind of see the messages shorten, and I'd see more of the specials and the sales start to work their way back in. Some of the better examples of that would be probably a mom-and-pop motel. Advertised God Bless America, $49 to $59. One of the ones I saw a bit later was sort of like an anniversary special. I call it Wash U Sad Day, but it's really meant to say Wash USA Day, Sunday, November 11th, 2001. I don't know if you save money or if you just commemorate the attacks by washing your car at that place that day. I don't know what happens, but it's Wash U Sad Day. And then we've got God Bless Captain McGregor, which was at Captain McGregor's. I guess they didn't feel the need to include America in that. In a way, I'm trying to pull together evidence of a response that shows this weird marriage of kind of crass commercialism with like a real genuine sort of pathos and like a need to unite and come together as a country. It's part of what makes the country so great and part of what makes it just hard to bear sometimes for me. So I was driving on these trips for about a month looking for signs. And then, you know, I wouldn't see quite as many. But what I did notice is I went up Route 1 for a photo shoot. It was right after the Patriots won. And on, you know, the butcher shop specials where it said God Bless America and on the auto acoustic sign where it used to say United We Stand. Now it said Go Pats, Wreck the Rams, or Congratulations Patriots, Super Bowl champs, or just Go Patriots. And it seems to be that was the thing that really kicked the God Bless America right off of there, you know? And it's interesting because the America Will Not Forget sign that's falling apart all over the place is still up. And that looks completely forgotten. Or maybe the owners are impressed with what it's saying as well as I am. But it's saying that it's time to really try to get back in day-to-day life. Strong response from people, and I'm getting the kind of response that feels really aligned with what I was setting out to do. People are saddened. Some people end up visibly moved by looking at all of this. People laugh in points. The basic response I'm getting is that it's a really powerful take from a different angle. I'm not trying to take a political stance with this and say fast food is bad and Route 1 is bad. I'm just in awe of everything that I've seen.
Ms. Linder is a photographer living in Boston. Her exhibit, God Bless America, Reading the Signs, will be at the gallery at the Piano Factory in Boston until March 2nd. You can view some of the photos in her exhibit by going to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.